Walton. I'm the president of the LA chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. We're very excited to have everybody here. This is our annual diversity event, and it's something a little bit different for us. We normally don't talk about this topic, so we're really excited about it. The timing worked out kind of well. It's been an interesting week. So we have a great panel for you. They're going to do about an hour talk by themselves, and then we'll have a Q&A at the end and open it up for a discussion. So if you have questions, if you have thoughts, please be ready to share. So let me introduce you our moderator for tonight. It's Los Angeles Times reporter Ken Schwenke. Did I say it right?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Ken, and we'll get started.
So on our panel today, we have Nick Adams, who is the Associate Director of Communications for GLAAD. We have Diane Anderson Minchel. She's the Editor-at-Large for The Advocate and the Editor-in-Chief of HIV Positive Magazine. We have Drian Juarez, who is a Program Manager for the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, the Trans Economic Empowerment Project. We have Isaac Perez, who is from Gender Justice LA, as a program director. And we are here to talk about transgender coverage in the media, which is something that media doesn't deal with all that often and can be very thorny and confusing when it does. So I'm going to just open this up straight up to the experts. And let's talk about what are some basic things that reporters, editors should keep in mind when discussing and writing about transgender issues.
Well, the terminology. You know, getting the terminology is right, and I assume we'll talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things that we see reporters having a problem with is actually relying too heavily on police reports, verbatim police reports, and the family sometimes, because those are often not great indicators of the gender identity and the names that a person is living under, those kinds of things. And then also the other things we see with reporters that I think are problematic are only covering trans people when they're victims of crime and not covering their broader lives.
I agree with everything Diane just said. And I also think that, you know, I started my activism career, well, basically I have been the L, the G, the B, and the T at some point or another in my life, so I have been across the spectrum. So before I came out as transgender, I was very involved in the gay and lesbian activism community. And I thought I understood diversity until I got into the trans community. And then I realized how spectacularly diverse the trans community is. And I think that that's often missed by the media. And it makes covering our community very complicated. So whether the diversity is, you know, issues of race, issues of class, issues of transgender women, issues of transgender men, issues of, are you transitioning at the age of 10 or are you transitioning at the age of 50? Are you a person who's transitioning and you're going to be gay when you're finished? Or are you a person who's transitioning and you're going to be heterosexual? Not finished is the wrong word, but are you heterosexual? So, I mean, there's so many, it's almost like three-dimensional chess when you start looking at all the different aspects of our community. And there, it's, I love that diversity in our community, but it's challenging, I think, for journalists when approaching it to try to capture that and to not make overgeneralizations.
And to really understand the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity, which is we're still working with reporters on getting that right in some places.
So why don't we talk about that? What would you say the differences, the divisions, how would you use those? Right.
Well, sexual orientation is, you know, can be loosely defined by how you define yourself in terms of your sexual attractions, your sexual identity. Are you gay? Are you lesbian? Are you straight? Are you bisexual? Are you queer? All those things are your sexual orientation. And then gender identity is how you define yourself in terms of your gender or your sex, which many think of as male, female. And then, of course, we know that there's a great spectrum that's either outside that or in between that that people still identify as with as well. But your gender identity has nothing to do with your sexual orientation, and there are straight people who are trans, and there's gay people who are trans, you know, some people who are trans come out of the LGB community, and a vast number of them do not. So that's why it's very important to get that right, because, you know, if you have a majority of people who are transgender who did not come through the, you know, gay and lesbian and bisexual community, It's just, you know, in confusing those two things actually really marginalizes them.
Yeah, so a simple way to think about it is your gender is what's between your ears. So how you conceive yourself to be who you are, whether you're male, you're female, or gender fluid, and your sexual orientation is what's in your heart, who you're attracted to. So they're different components of who we are.
Mine has to do with my vagina as well.
Yeah, everyone has a gender identity. So, you know, you don't have to be trans. Everyone in this room has a gender identity, whether you're trans or not. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. For transgender people, it's challenging when your gender identity doesn't match your body. So a very simple description of what transgender is that. And it's confusing, I think, for the world in general that we have this acronym, LGBT, that we all use all the time, every day. And so the first three are about sexual orientation, and then the last one is about gender identity. And the reason we use it as an acronym, and the reason that we often work together, is that people hate us for exactly the same reasons. Well, there's many reasons why we work together, but that's a big one. And, you know, like, a lot of the discrimination faced by gay and lesbian people and bisexual people is because they are perceived to be defying what's appropriate for their gender, right? So a little boy who's perceived to be a sissy on the playground and is getting bullied for being a fag, it's not typically because the other kids have seen him kissing a boy, it's because they think he's doing something that is considered too effeminate. And transgender people, you know, half the world still thinks we're just another form of gay and hate us for that reason. So there's a reason why it's one acronym, even though they are two distinct issues. But they also overlap. So I am transgender. I was born female and have transitioned about 15 years ago. But I'm also a gay man, and I've been with my partner for 12 years. So I'm now both the T and the G at this point.
Yeah, the other thing that's really interesting when you're talking about why the LGBT is together, because also a lot of our organizations would still actually include people who are intersex and people who are asexual under the same umbrella. But when you're talking about that, one of the main issues that a lot of trans activists are pushing for right now, and all LGBT activists should be pushing for, is employment non-discrimination acts, and the federal and on state levels. And but it's interesting to point the first people who have had lawsuits around gender, you know, issues related to gender expression, have all been actually straight women. So straight women who are forced to wear makeup to work, forced to wear skirts to work, those kinds of things. Those are some of the earliest lawsuits, but those are all lawsuits based on how they presented themselves because they didn't want to do those things. And but now we're, you know, we talk about them almost exclusively as trans issues when really they're issues that affect really wide spectrum of people.
Let's get into a couple of these specifics as far as terminology goes. We have, you know, transgender, and you have gender queer, and you have all of these various terms that can be very confusing to people who have never dealt with them, or met trans people, or anything like that. So, Zach, maybe we can start with you on terminology.
Hello. Hi, everybody. Yeah, I think I could speak to the gender queer terminology. I think for a long time, and still do, I identify as gender queer, and for me, what that meant was really not really feeling male or female, and somewhere in between or outside of that. That's been my experience, and I think as a person who wasn't physically transitioning at the time, that was really a way for me to be able to explain my own identity to folks. You know, I think it's just a newer term, and I think it's important to actually include genderqueer as well in the.
Zach, can I ask you, if a reporter were to ask you what you would, how you would label yourself as trans or genderqueer or something, what would you tell them?
I basically use both terms. I'm a genderqueer trans person.
So trans is the umbrella term, right?
Yeah, trans. Oh, you want to go ahead? Oh, I was going to say, you know, trans is the umbrella term. And if somebody has, for us at least, you know, we really want to be on the cutting edge of how people define themselves. And we have to make, you know, I hate when they don't want to pick a pronoun. And so we'll do anything to get around that because editors hate that. But I think that when somebody self-identifies as something, if it's, you know, we'll say that they're transgender or trans. We just use trans quite a bit. We just make sure we don't use trans man and trans woman as all one word because trans is just an adjective like, black man, white woman, fat lady. So we use trans quite a bit, transgender, and they're the umbrella terms. But if somebody self-identifies with something that is, you know, more specific, because you certainly have people who are like gender defiant, binary, busty, you know, all those different things. Genderqueer is pretty normalized for us at this point, but any of those other things, we'll just say who self-identifies as the following. And one of the things that we come up with is we have people who self-identify occasionally with words that are no longer used by us because they're not considered good words to use. So hermaphrodite is used. You don't want to use hermaphrodite anymore. The word for that would be intersex. You don't want to use transvestite. That word would be crossdresser, and that would be exclusively for somebody who is actually a crossdresser, a drag performer. You never want to use that for a trans woman or a trans man. Transsexual is a word that some, mostly trans women, still use, and so if they ask to use it, we will specify who identifies as a transsexual to indicate that we're going outside our normal style guideline with this, because that's what they've asked us to use. Shemale, you never want to use. Tranny, you never want to use. I don't care who's hurling it in one sentence. Again, you never want to use crossdresser or a drag queen when you really mean trans women. We see that in the media still all the time. We don't use gender identity disorder anymore. We use gender dysphoria. I'm trying to think of what else there is. Oh, woman born woman. Those kinds of terms. Or was born a man, was born a woman. We want to say assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth.
So you bring up some interesting things. Because in a lot of news articles you'll read who, you know, something along the lines of who was born a man, or, you know, or to use the person's birth name to initially identify them and then use their chosen name. What do you have to say about that? What are the best ways to handle things like, you know, your preferred name and gender pronoun?
Well, your preferred name and your preferred gender pronoun should always be the first thing that's used. If the paper absolutely must use the birth name that they're assigned at birth, you know, then that would be a secondary thing. But most trans people and most you know, progressive activists don't do that anymore. It's still seen as, again, both disrespectful and also not recognizing this person's current gender, this person's current situation. By using the name that they were given at birth, you could be, you know, outing that person, for example. Like, that is not who that person is, and you want to have your name used as your name is. So, not whatever you got called when you were, you know, in third grade.
And also, you can't necessarily be a stickler about have they had a legal name change, because first of all, this town is filled with celebrities who've never had a legal name change, and they're always report on as whatever their name is, and nobody goes and fact checks did they ever get a court ordered name change.
And they have no last names too.
Some of them, yeah.
And you still respect that.
But then also, like, there's tremendous amounts of obstacles for trans people to be able to get some court ordered name changes, both financial obstacles. Sometimes there are surgical requirements that the person doesn't have the resources to meet or doesn't want to meet. So saying, you know, that, or it hasn't been old enough to have a court ordered name change without parental approval. So there's all kinds of reasons not to rely on that as the truth, because society is not built to help trans people make those kinds of changes easily. So yeah, I would go with and be respectful of, if they say this is my name, just go with that.
And if they're dead and their friends say this is her name, please use that name. That's the bottom line.
I also think you can't go by body parts as well. You know, I think a lot of the times the assumption is that your gender is defined by your body parts, and they're not. Even if a person hasn't had SRS, that's not the end goal for everyone. So it's about respecting that person's identity, their lived truth, rather than what people say about them or how they used to know them. So.
Yeah, I mean, that takes us back to the Cleveland fiasco earlier this year. I guess everybody who's a reporter in here probably knows about the Cleveland fiasco. So
I have to explain.
Oh, okay, so, sorry. The Cleveland plane dealer originally reported a story where you know, the story was very small, and it was basically, you know, a man wearing strange clothing, possibly women's clothing, found dead in a ditch. And then, you know, it was very, you know, just a sort of offensive, and it just painted this picture. It's very offensive.
It was also
in the way
like a mugshot run with the story from the prime when this person was arrested and bringing up her criminal past, which was completely irrelevant.
And used the birth name.
Yeah.
Used the birth name.
It was
not
kind of a hodgepodge of
it was
what
a
wrong
hot
things
mess.
To do. And it was like, this is exactly what not to do.
Yeah, and in today's world, of course, then everybody else ran with it, ran with all this bad language and stuff, and so it took, you know, some brokering to get, you know, to get it down and to get all of those. Did you have anything to do with retraining the staff there? Because that happened afterwards.
Yeah, we worked with the local groups in Ohio who were trying to go address them, and here's the thing I want to say. It's like GLAAD deals with journalists all the time. And a lot of times, it's just ignorance. Like, you don't know what this word means, or you don't even realize you've made a mistake. And GLAAD's attitude is always to reach out and educate and say, hey, you may not have known, but this is not really right, and let us help you make that story more respectful and more accurate. And that's fine. We have no problem with that. But then when you say that to someone, and they're like, we don't agree with you, and we really don't care, and we're not going to change it, that's when the rubber hits the road. So at that point, like, the Ohio groups and the Cleveland groups really got involved and were protesting and demanded a meeting, and we couldn't go to that meeting, but they went, and things presumably got a little better. But it's not just Cleveland, which you might think, oh, that's podunk Cleveland.
No,
we had a problem with the New York Times recently when a transgender woman died in a fire in her home, and the reporter who covered that story in the very first sentence described her as curvaceous, described that she had taken men up to her room, that she was known to be friendly with lots of men, that in the debris found outside her home were makeup and women's shoes and feather boas and all this kind of like extraneous. Why would you, if that had been a non-transgender woman who was murdered in a fire, you wouldn't be reporting on her looks or what, you know, what kind of clothes she had or wore. It was so disrespectful and trivializing of this woman's life. So that was the New York Times. So we had
and you couldn't decide too with that. Were they trying to overcompensate and say, we know it, she's a woman, she's a woman? Or were they trying to just be exploitive? Like, I couldn't figure it out. It was just like, it was terrible, too.
It was not good.
Yeah,
you actually bring up an interesting point. If a reporter in their course of their duty is interviewing a trans person, at what point, you know, should they include that information in their story, you know, a trans person? Or at what point are you modifying the story to include that for more interest? So you might imagine that in that New York Times story, it added a bit of interest and intrigue. This was a trans woman, and her feather boas were flying all over the yard. But at what point are you overstepping your bounds in describing this person as a trans person?
Well, I think that, you know, again, it really depends on the story. In this particular case, you know, this is somebody who was openly trans in her community. So, it, you know, noting that she was transgender woman wasn't the problem at all. Because a lot of, you know, again, when we have a lot of trans people, they're, you know, they're parts of their community, they're out. Those are, it's not an issue to report on them being trans any more than it would be an issue to report on them being a person of color or, you know, an activist with Greenpeace or whatever. So it's really about, in that particular case, the sort of sensationalization, you know, feather boas don't necessarily ring trans to me. It almost indicates you're trying to say she's a showgirl or something, which is, you know, sort of the opposite thing again. So I think that it's like, you know, but again, if you're doing a story that's on doc shows and somebody says I'm trans or somebody says I'm with the trans contingent, then it's important. But if they don't and you have to be like, well, are you trans? Then it doesn't seem like it's relevant to your story.
Yeah, and in this instance, I think there was some sense that she may have been murdered because she was trans. This wasn't an accidental fire. So you want to continue, you know, report on that as a possible hate crime and put it into the context of the spectacular amount of violence leveled against transgender women in this culture. But that is not about what she wore, what she looked like. That's like saying the rape victim wore a short skirt. Like, it's that is irrelevant, you know? So.
Yeah. Is Dr. Young, do you want to add that?
Yeah, I think it's just common sense. I mean, like, you know, think about it. And, again, just echoing what people said, think about, is it important to the story and does it need to be said? That's just important to double check.
Yeah, and you don't want to trivialize somebody's life or something that was so horrible. And I think that pointing out those tidbits doesn't do anything for the story or doesn't do anything for what happened to this person. It's just trivializing that whole experience, so it's very insensitive.
Actually, I want to say, just backing up a little bit. So, like, a lot of these things that we've talked about right now where it was examples of bad reporting, it was breaking news in the wake of a crime. And so GLAAD actually has an entire report on our website called Doubly Victimized, Reporting on Transgender Victims of Crime, because oftentimes in that case, the journalists may have just been on, they're not a journalist who specializes on the LGBT beat. They just get assigned, they're a crime reporter or a metro reporter, and they get assigned this story, and they show up, and it's a transgender victim, and they're relying on what the police say. They may be relying on what family members say, who in the family member may not even have known their family member was trans, or may not have accepted that they were trans, because family members can continue to use old names and pronouns. My parents still sometimes use she in my old name, and I tell them not to do it in public because people are going to think you have Alzheimer's. And
my husband's parents do the same thing when they say something.
So the problem, really, a lot of the bad reporting comes out of that situation where, and that's why we put out this special report on how to report when there's a crime, and we would encourage you, if you are assigned a case where there is a crime, to immediately, like, try to find either a local group or talk to GLAAD about, like, how can I navigate this without being insensitive, because that's particularly harmful when there's a crime involved and the person has been victimized or killed. Probably most of you have seen Boys Don't Cry. But what you may not know is Brandon Tina is not buried under a headstone that says Brandon Tina. Brandon Tina is buried under a headstone that says Tina Brandon, daughter, beloved sister, whatever. And that kind of thing, where the thought of being that disrespected in death is really powerful for trans people. So when we see it happen from the news media, it's like that for us, right? So those kind of situations, the reporting typically is bad. I have also at GLAAD seen for years now excellent reporting about the transgender community, but it's the feature stories. It's when that reporter has time to talk to trans people for a couple of months or even a couple of weeks and really get one family's story in depth. Or I worked with Mary McNamara at the LA Times 12 years ago on a three-piece article she did about the trans community in LA, and she spent 6 months on it. So those kinds of stories, I find that journalists really usually do a very good job, but it's that crime story, that breaking news, got to be on deadline, got to get this out, and it's often just terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, that was 12 years ago. Nobody's got 3 months to work on a story anymore. So, but I think the Cleveland fiasco did show, because basically news of who this person's identity was came out within hours. So it kind of showed, and the paper there doesn't have a competitor, so I don't know who they're beating to the traffic here. But if they had just slowed down and taken an extra hour beyond the police report to do some, like, you know, hoof on the ground reporting, they would have found out everything that had come out, you know, within an hour, basically. So it's like slowing down and getting more information before you report it. You know that's going to be a big story. Somebody found mutilated in a drain, you know, half-dressed. That's going to be a story, so do some real reporting on it.
May I ask, what are some examples of some of the best reporting on the trans community that you've seen?
My own publications.
Outside of The Advocate, and perhaps in the mainstream media.
Well, I'm lucky because one of the things I do at GLAAD is I run the nominations process for the GLAAD Media Awards, so I get to spend a lot of time looking at good stuff, which is great. So, like recently, last year or the year before she won, Bella English wrote a story for the Boston Globe about the Maines family, and they have twins where one is a transgender girl and the other one is not transgender, and they spent a lot of time talking to that family and what this means, and, you know, and it was a very human interest story, like a profile of this family with a little bit of an activist bent, because the Maines just recently sued for the right for their daughter to use the girls' bathroom at her school. So, and again, like, that's a specific example. Weirdly, also another thing about trans children, skipping to broadcast journalism for a bit, it's older now, but especially forgiven for how old it is. I want to say it was 7 years ago. Barbara Walters did a 2020 thing on trans children.
The one with Jazz?
Yeah, yeah. When Jazz was like five.
I Am Jazz. The
no, like even
yeah before year, that.
Yeah. And I think that piece, which we gave the GLAAD Media Award to her for. Like, now, 7 years later, you might watch it and think, well, that's not exactly right. But especially for 7 years ago, it was right on the cutting edge of groundbreaking for mainstream media. And I work with a group here in L.A. called Transforming Family for families with transgender kids from ages 5 to 24. And so many of those families either saw that special or watched it on YouTube when they started Googling transgender kids and made a huge difference in their lives because it profiled, like, four families with trans youth. So that was also an example of, you know, Barbara Walters just hitting a topic right on the head and doing a really great hour-long piece on it that was awesome. And especially how long ago it was. Everyone's writing about transgender kids now. But back then, nobody really was.
He's like, you made a face when I asked that question.
I think it's kind of, it's interesting, and that I can't think of any good stories. And, you know, I think that that's part of the problem, is that a lot of these stories aren't being put out there in a light that's positive, and that's really, you know, people covering our community in a positive way. So I think it's a big problem.
Yeah, the same thing. I was stumped a little bit. I couldn't think of a report that I saw that was really, really good, that really stood out for me. And, you know, that just speaks to how many bad stories there are that you feel that that's all there is. So I'm kind of in alignment with you.
I think there's, like, you know, a couple. I think the two is, you know, we'll see some spot reporting. You know, the Atlantic had a good piece this year. Salon has done some good stuff, and, you know, so you've seen it in you know, bits and pieces, but not as an overall consistent legacy.
And in terms of consistency, I think Huffington Post Gay Voices, in spite of its title, has allowed a platform for a lot of trans people to write things in their own words, which has been great. And I also want to shout out to the LA Times, because they did just write a story on Sunday about trans pride, which happened here on this very stage last weekend. And it was a great story, because it wasn't about a crime, it wasn't about tragedy, it wasn't about the spectacular amounts of discrimination faced by our community. It was a profile of the 14th annual Trans Pride in LA, attended by around 400 to 500 people, celebrating the strengths in our community and the organizations that are providing services, the organizations that are providing training, like Dreons. And it was great to have that side of our community shown in the paper, and not just, you know, here's another hate crime, you know, Viv for Vivian Diego, she's being attacked on the way home from baseball, which is also important, but it's not the only side of our community.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is my, like, you know, you would ask, like, what are some of the best practices, and that, I think, is one of the main things that I want reporters to take away, which is to report on trans people when they're not victims of crime, so that when you do report on them, you know, you have a fuller breadth of them, because what's happening is, for most trans people, they only see coverage that's victims about trans people that are victims of crime. And so you really don't, you know, they're not seeing them in the lifestyle sections or in other local sections. And that's actually what's going to really make the coverage seem like it's, you know, comparable to other people.
Well, like, you were written about in the New York Times with your husband.
I was when he transitioned 8 years ago.
And what did they think about that
butchered
story?
It? No, they butchered it. Yeah, we.
What were some of the specific problems you saw in it? Because I read it and I thought you might have something to say.
God, I'm trying to remember. You know, there was just sort of like I think that the reporter, you know, just sort of didn't quite get everything, and so. There was a lot that was lost in translation. There was a lot of focus on this, you know, one couple. There was a lot of focus on them not being able to survive the transition, one partner's transition and stay together, and they had a child. And so I think that set the tone for the rest of the article. And I can't really even remember the specifics. What I remember mostly is that after it came out, you know, a lot of trans people hated it, and we were like, well, at least the New York Times is talking about us. And Dan Savage, who is, you know, most people probably know, is a big, he's the guy who founded the It Gets Better campaign, and he has a column in The Stranger in Seattle still called Hey Faggot. It's an advice column he's had for over 20 years now, I think. Anyway, after it came out, he wrote that that my relationship was proof that women's lesbian sexual identity was fluid beyond ridiculousness, something like that. So I sort of remember that more than I remember the actual article.
And so even in the non-mainstream media, it can be a little...
It can be really dicey.
Back to that LGB means one thing and T means another. I mean, this is not just an educational campaign that has to be undertaken with straight people or the media. I mean, even within the LGBT community, we have to educate the LGBs about the T. And sometimes for those, you know, let's say 50-year-old transgender woman who's transitioning from being a married man living in the suburbs with kids to perhaps becoming a lesbian woman and has never spent a minute in the LGB community, they often have to be educated as well, kind of about, well, what is this LGB community I've all of a sudden now just
walked into. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done, and that's a perfect example when you hear negative things from gay people. It's
and I'll say too, the other thing is my when I started the Advocate 2 years ago, and one of my main things that I had told my boss when I got brought in was one of my missions was to really increase the visibility of trans people on our pages, just their lives and their issues, because I felt like we had done a piss poor job in the past. And so we did, on our 45th anniversary last year, we did this, we looked at 45 years of the magazine, and we tallied up the number of times that words like gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender had each appeared on the magazine cover. And gay, of course, had appeared, you know, four bazillion times. And transgender had appeared 8 times total, and 6 of them had been done in the year that I was there. So it's like we had really done a bad job, and but I still have, you know, I'll still have battles with my editors above me over, they're very often, they like to use the word gay to mean everybody. So even like this cover, God, I hope my boss isn't the audience, even the cover that we have coming out right now, it's like Black Gay American, and one of the featured people is Laverne Cox, the transgender actress. You know, and I... And exactly, and I told my boss, if Laverne's there, you can't use gay, you have to use LGBT. And it's always this aesthetic thing. Well, LGBT just doesn't look as good as gay. It doesn't ring. It doesn't, you know, I'm just like, I'm sorry, but it's a definition, people. So even at what I think is one of the best at covering trans people's lives, at least, you know, in the last year, is still fucking up.
Isaac and John, do you have any experience with the media, with reporters? Specifically,
that you'd
like to talk about?
Yeah. For me, I work with a lot of people who deal with employment issues and employment discrimination, and oftentimes it's just, you know, giving bad information and painting transgender people as, you know, wearing a costume to go to work or wearing a costume to just have access to the women's restroom. And they never balance that out with, you know, actually speaking to a trans person or actually examining what trans is. So for me, it's always been about, you know, this information that gets lost and really affects people in a profound way. You know, it makes it difficult for people to get jobs, to go out on the street and feel safe. And I think that's the way that I really am affected by bad reporting, is that I see how trans people are not able to get jobs because people read these stories and they think, oh, so this is a man who used to be a woman who used to be a man, rather than a transgender woman. So for me, it's very real, and I see how it affects people in their lives day to day.
And that's because reporters have used crazy people as a way to, like, we're going to be objective, so we're going to use this crazy person who doesn't understand science as our, like, you know, counterpoint,
right,
to that. And so they're the ones
who
are always...
in gay reporting as well. You know, you pick the most homophobic person you can find, and he's the counterpoint.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, but they're always the ones who are worried about having to have a man in a tutu work at their office, right? So I don't know what they're so worried about, but that sounds lovely to me. But yeah, so I think that sets up that same thing.
Do anything to that?
I'm sorry, can we go back to the question?
Sex, like,
we're
tuning
talking
out
about
of this,
a specific, any specific interactions you've ever had with reporters or...
Henry in the audience came to one of our events Gender Justice LA did, and you know, we didn't have coverage there, but, like, you know, it was an opportunity for reporters to come and to actually focus on what our Theater of the Press group was doing, which is really around Know Your Rights and focusing on the school to prison pipeline with transgender youth and how that affects our community. So I mean,
maybe define maybe school to prison
pipeline for the audience. Yes, so you can actually find this diagram. It's online with an organization called Fierce, and basically the school to prison pipeline is when youth are, they drop out of school and they are put, or they're pushed out because of harassment or discrimination from teachers, peers, and then what happens? They leave school, or they're kicked out, they're not wanted, so then they don't go to college. And then other factors are, you know, they're kicked out of their homes because they're either abused by their family members, or or they're not able to express themselves, so then they're also become homeless, and then that leads to unemployment, and then also in the foster care system, where again is a huge problem, where foster youth are discriminated in again, and so in all walks of life they become homeless, and then are further policed by police, and are put into jail for street survival or for just being on the street. So they're targeted basically. So and then they end up in the prison system. It's a huge problem, and it's something that I think needs to be covered like right away, right now.
But GSA National just had a big report about this. In fact, especially about the sort of push out that they're getting from schools. That's kind of, you know, when you have kids that are considered like willful disobedience, but it's really because they won't wear, you know, the clothes in the other gender identity that's different than theirs, or things like that. So
yeah, and I definitely was one of those youth that was pushed out of high school for expressing myself in a way that wasn't correct according to them. So you know, I had a hard time further down life, you know, and it was a big issue. It was because just trying to express myself as a youth, and I'm being told that that's wrong.
So that's a big story that you would say is going uncovered mostly by the media. Are there any other, I'm sure there are many others. Mm-hmm. And so let's just go back along the lines and talk about stories that you think aren't being covered in favor of these pure sort of crime stories that tend to get the most coverage.
You know, successful trans people who are living full lives, I think it's important to cover that. Sometimes it's not as sexy as somebody who's been murdered or killed, but I think that that's what really causes for a lot of youth to grow up thinking that they're alone, because they don't see role models of themselves. They don't see people who are living full lives, and all they read about is all these horrible crimes, so they're even afraid to be themselves. So I think more coverage of mentors, of people who are doing good work out in the world, living full lives, I think that's really important, because it's putting that lens of positivity on our experience so that youth have something to look up to. I feel the same way in terms of growing up in East Los Angeles, not knowing that there were gay people, much less trans people, and I never met a trans person until my 20s. So I think for youth, it's important to change that and to start letting them know that they can grow up to be successful and not live in fear and not have to get hurt for being who they are. So I think positive role model stories of people doing good work are really, really important, and I would love to see more of that.
I'm going to go back to what you were talking about just a few minutes ago, because there's so many facets of that story, the alarmingly high rates of trans youth who are on the streets or gender nonconforming youth who are on the streets, and that leads to, again, alarmingly high rates of trans men and women who are forced into the street economy, that's drugs or sex work. Among trans women, 1 in 3 had been forced into sex work to survive, 1 in 5 trans men, I think the number is. So if you think about, those are alarmingly high rates, and they actually affect so many things. I think that we had some sensational stories coming out around pumping parties last year, because there were some deaths related to that. So pumping parties are actually parties where generally, it'll be mostly trans women, but there have been other gender variant folks that go to these. And you go, and it's a way to get low cost silicone injections, what you hope are silicone injections, and very often there are other things that are mixed in there, like cement. Or they use commercial grade silicone, the kind you can find at Home Depot, not the medical grade that you're supposed to put in your body. And they have very serious health effects, including death. But I think that people tend to be like, oh, that monster, look what she's done to those people. And then they book them, and then the story is over, right? But we actually know that a very high number of trans women, especially because they don't have the money to go to physicians to have these procedures that insurance consider cosmetic many times, even though you need them to fill out a female form. So there are high numbers of women doing this. You know, we should look at the subculture. We should look at different things like that. And then on the non-investigative side, I do think that we should take things that are timely and work them into more universal stories. So like the blogger who does Raising My Rainbow, she's got a new book out about raising a gender variant kid, and she's got this, you know, cute little child who was assigned male at birth and, you know, who plays with dolls and dresses up and wears girls' clothes one day and boys' clothes another, and, you know, they're kind of just letting that child be, you know, and raising him, and they've become, you know, these activists for kids and for LGBT rights and stuff like that. These, you know, straight married couple in Massachusetts or whatever. And that would be really great to take a story like that and talk with somebody like that who's got this book that's just coming out, and then seek out those families in our community and, you know, and cover them, because there are so many. And I think that that's... those are stories that people really find a lot of impact. I know one of the things for us, my husband's trans, I think we covered that, and he came out as trans 8 years ago. Before that, we spent 16 years as a lesbian couple. And a lot of people, the endless fascination they have is like, how did you transition? How did you survive? How did your marriage survive? How do you define yourself now? And that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, those are universal stories that any trans person can tell you, you know? And I think that there are stories, though, that can have resonance to non-trans readers as well. These are universal stories about love and family and acceptance. And the same thing when you have somebody in a high-powered career. For God's sake, somebody get Lana Wachowski to talk to them. She won't talk with me. But she would be a coup for anybody in this room. You know, those people who have a lot of power, you know? And those are great universal stories as well. So
around the Wachowski.
Siblings. You say siblings now.
At this point. You know, a lot of that coverage was kind of periodically driven as well.
It was like, Lana's so hot. Yeah, look at that.
Or it was a lot of, is she or isn't she? Because she chose not to speak about it for a long time, which I think every trans person has the right to do. It's an intense experience. And, you know, not wanting to share it with the world right off the bat, I totally understand. So there was a lot of, like, can we catch her out? Is she really? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and it was, like, sort of painted as kind of a weirdo at first,
yeah.
Right?
But then she gave a speech at HRC last fall, I guess, maybe?
When she came out,
It was amazing speech, and talked about it in a lot for her PR tour for Cloud Atlas. So I feel like that's improved some once she was, you know, able and ready to speak about her own life and her own experience. But, yeah, that original kind of coverage was very icky.
I was going to say, that does remind me of one of the major pitfalls that we see when media is covering trans issues, and that is to focus all of your attention on the snip-snip, basically, which is my shorthand for what do you have going on down there. So they want to, very often we hear reporters, we have a storyline that, for Jake and I, that when we talk with other reporters, that we basically say we don't talk about his genitals unless you want to talk to me about your genitals. And that's because, you know, for us, it's like by focusing on whether which surgery he has or haven't had, it kind of marginalizes people who don't have access to surgery or don't want to have surgery, and it kind of positions us as like, I'm better than you, that kind of thing. So I think that that's one thing that reporters, and that we hear a lot still from the mainstream media that...
Sorry,
we hear that a lot, but we hear...
just interviewed by...
That's said husband...
We were just interviewed by Seattle Gay News, which came out on Friday.
Yes.
And that reporter, who was a gay man, and he was a very nice person, also asked many of these same invasive...
He definitely...
Very,
yeah, we were reported... So he's saying... We talked with a reporter at Seattle Gay News, and he had asked a lot of questions about Jake's gender reassignment, which is the proper term for sex change, and... or sex reassignment, if you want to call it that. And, you know, and he wanted to know, like, are you done? What all surgeries have you had? You know, and it's very invasive questions, and it doesn't really respect that for many trans people, there's no done, you know? Like, for trans men, surgeries, bottom surgeries are wildly inexpensive, not covered by surgery.
Wildly expensive.
Wildly expensive and not wildly functional for some of them, you know. Like phalloplasties are major surgeries that have a lot of pitfalls, so a lot of trans men decide not to have that surgery, for example. And that's a whole long thing. And for trans women, again, you have the economics issue, and if you don't have insurance that covers it, and a lot of insurance doesn't, then you can't have transition surgery. But everybody wants to know about that as though if you haven't had surgery, you're not a real man or you're not a real woman.
I think invasiveness and sensitivity is a really interesting topic, and let's get to that next. But Nick, I wanted to ask you whether there were, what sort of stories that you would like to see that you think are interesting that aren't being covered right now?
Yes, I have a list. well, I wanted to say, first of all, back to the crime stories or the street economy stories, there are real issues of class in this community, and there are real issues of discrimination. So to give you really quickly some statistics from a report called Injustice at Every Turn, trans people are 4 times more likely to live in poverty. Trans people experience unemployment at twice the rate of the general population, and for people of color, it's up to 4 times the national unemployment rate. 90% of trans people report experiencing harassment, mistreatment, or discrimination on the job. That's 90%. Half reported being uncomfortable seeking police assistance due to discrimination from the police. 41% of the respondents reported attempting suicide, compared to 1.6% of the general population. That's not because trans people are crazy. It's because we live in a world that makes it so incredibly difficult to be trans that suicide often seems like the only option.
Did you say 41%?
41%. And those are the people who are alive to answer the survey. And by the way, transgender people still can't serve in the United States military, so even though Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, that doesn't apply to trans people. And just last year, the National Anti-Violence Project reported that of all the LGBT people murdered in 2012, 53% were transgender women. Transgender women are not 53% of the LGBT community, not even close, but they're 53% of the murder victims, and they're mostly women of color. So when these street economy stories come up around sex work, around silicon parties, around drugs, around arrests, around murders, around attacks, I'd like to see journalists put that into the context of the incredibly discriminatory culture that trans people live in, particularly when there's an intersection of being transgender and being a person of color, or being a transgender person and being poor, which, as you can see, is a lot of trans folk.
Yeah, do you have the number, actually, on the number? There's that number about the percentage of trans people who have make less than $11,000 a year.
Yeah, it was some ridiculous amount, and I can't remember what it is.
It's huge and alarming.
So, so for those reasons, there is a reason to cover that aspect of our community. But, that being said, Dreon said, if you're a trans person and that's literally all you see reflected back to you, you think, I should kill myself. Why wouldn't you? So the flip side of that is the positive stories that aren't being covered. So Trans Pride LA, which we just got coverage on and I was really thrilled about. The LA Trans Film Festival, which has been happening here for many years, usually in November. It's separate from Alfest. Deserves coverage. It's amazing. There's not that many cities where we have our own transgender film festival, and Gender Justice LA is one of the co-sponsors of that. Talking to people like Lana Wachowski or some of the other trans people in Hollywood who are being successful. So this is a Hollywood town. So you have Candace Cain, you have Laverne Cox, you have Ian Harvey. There's some people who Jamie Clayton, who are making it in the industry here, and that would be an angle for the LA Times or any other reporter here in Hollywood. This year we came out, you know how the Out, speaking of the Advocate and Out, the Out has its Out 100 list every year, and usually there's 2 or 3 trans people included. Great to be there, but that's not very many out of 100. So this year a couple people in the trans community got together and created the Trans 100 list. So 100 people around the country who are doing great and amazing work for the trans community. There's 100 personal interest, human interest stories in that list. And how did you get on the Trans 100? What are you doing?
And they're great stories, too. Everybody has, there's really interesting backstories. Yeah. These are not just, I became an activist, I graduated college and became an activist, and now I'm this on. These are...
Yeah, really great.
Fascinating.
And then the issue about the homelessness, one of the stories here in L.A. is that the L.A. Gay and Lesbian Center has the RISE program, which got a grant to look at how can we help LGBT homeless youth and stay in the foster system, but again, such a high percentage of those youth are either transgender identified or very gender non-conforming, so a lot of the issues around, kicking kids out of foster care or not having a place for them in a shelter because the shelter is divided into boy and girl is around issues of gender. So how is the center using that grant to look at how we solve those problems and keep kids off the street and, not homeless? So, there's
and
a lot of really great stories.
Too. You've got the parents who actually exclusively foster parent trans kids and gender-varying kids. So there's a human interest story that, it's not just this wonky, number story about the grant. There's human interest element there that you can get from either side, the parents, the kids, et cetera.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's my answer to your question. Sorry.
Zach, do you have anything to add?
Yes. So I wanted to say, like, all of that is really super important. And also, I think that the everyday trans person living day to day is also very important to cover. You know, I think so for people who don't go to college or who drop out of school or are pushed out of school, there are less opportunities. And to develop your voice and to be empowered is huge. And if that's not there, then folks aren't going to be able to rally up. They're not going to be able to work on policies that change the lives of trans people. So I think it's just also important to just hold up people in this room every day, people that are surviving and that are also organizing around change. So I wanted to say that.
I also really love the stories about our families and our loved ones, because when we transition our entire lives. We transition our families, our work environments, where we live. So the people around us also go through this profound change, and I think their stories are really powerful for our allies to read as well, mm-hmm. in terms of how they can support us or how they can just be there for us. And so I think those are also really great stories that our families need to read as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I have maybe time for one more pointed question before we open up to the audience. When you were talking about the reporter who had been asking your husband basic questions, where is sort of the line? I think that reporters and people who don't deal with trans people in general are maybe uncomfortable talking about it to begin with, and maybe once they cross that uncomfortable line, they probably just barrel too far into it. So where is the line? You know, at what point is, you know, how much is too much? What sort of questions are just off limits, and what sort of questions should they be asking?
You know, I think you could turn around to the reporter and say, well, if people were asking you about your genitals, or do you feel comfortable with that? And I think, you know, people are so fascinated with our genitals, and especially in the workplace, the bathroom issue becomes about, is this trans woman, does she have a penis, and what's she going to do in the bathroom with it, and is it safe for us? And so people have so much fear around our bodies and what we do with them and how they function, and I think we really have to diffuse that, and I think talking to trans people in a respectful way is the best way of doing it, not sensationalizing it. I think it's really important. And so really, if you wouldn't like somebody to ask you about your genitals, think about the trans person if that would be comfortable for them. And, you know, I think that's a good gauge for that.
We generally say, ask when somebody, you know, when did you come out as a trans person or when did you come out as a transgender man, that kind of thing, rather than asking when did you have a sex change or, you know, that kind of stuff. So ask when did you transition and let them define what transition means. Because you know they've transitioned because they are trans. So just let them define what that means, and if they want to tell you about their surgeries, they'll tell you. And but beyond that, I wouldn't ask. And there are plenty of people who will tell you, you know, everything that they went through. But generally, we draw the line at the surgery questions.
And you don't want to say, "Are you complete?" Oh, are you real? You
know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not great.
Yeah. What Dreon said earlier was that gender is between your ears and sexual orientation is in your heart. She didn't say gender is between your legs. You know what I mean? Like, it's really for us about getting our bodies in alignment and in a way that is comfortable with our minds. And the mind is the key element there, and it's not what surgeries we have or had or hadn't had. So that always seems a little bit tawdry and sensationalistic when you start fixating on surgeries and particularly genital surgeries. And that's, I think that's like the line right there.
And the way that manifests itself in our community is that then you have pumping parties or where people go and get, you know, surgeries in TJ because they feel that's the way that I can be valid in my identity, because there's so much focus on surgeries and passing and looking a certain way that our children, you know, grow up thinking that this is what I have to do in order to be authentic. So
yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. Trans people want bodies that are gender congruent, mostly. They want bodies that match the vision they have in their heads. But they can't all have them. So, you know, prodding over what they do have doesn't help anybody. It doesn't get us any place.
I was just going to add to what Dreon was saying around, like, asking things like, you know, how do you have sex?
I've had that question asked to me directly.
Yes.
In a panel being filmed for Showtime, that was the very first question asked of me, is how do you have sex?
Well, we...
None of your business! And I tried to say it much nicer. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. He's like, you just touched a nerve there. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I've actually interrupted everybody on the panel today, so...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, similar in the gay community, where, you know, you tell people you're gay, and they want to ask you, are you a top or a bottom? And you're like, well, I'm not asking you.
Unless we're going to get that, it's really none of your business.
Right. Well, before we open up to the audience, is there anything else, I'll just go on down the line, that each of you want to add?
Yeah, so really big on Gender Justice LA. Me, I'm really big on providing resources. It's really important that we get resources to the community and to you all. So if you could, if you want, you can grab some, I love some pamphlets and some Know Your Rights tools and just a lot of information. Please grab it on your way out. And if you have any questions, if you want to know more about the organization I work for, which again is Gender Justice LA, please contact me. My email is Ezak, E-Z-A-K, at gjla.org.
For me, I think, you know, you people, being in Los Angeles is an amazing city, and there are some incredible resources, the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, Justice, GLAAD. So you, reporters, have resources to find positive stories. It's just about making those connections and building those relationships. And so I think what's important is for reporters to go out there, educate themselves, and build these relationships so that they can get the right information out there. Because these stories are powerful, and they're affecting people in ways that we can't even think about now. You're thinking about youth who are reading these stories. So you have a big responsibility in the way that you affect society. And so really connecting with people who are living that experience, I think, is really important to get a good story out there.
Everything she said, plus I'm a top. I just felt like it was important to put that out.
So backing up a little bit, this is one of the points I want to make. So media images of transgender people are at least 20 and possibly 30 years behind where media images are of gay and lesbian people. So in the 1960s and 70s, most Americans would say they didn't know a gay person, even though they probably did, and they just didn't know it. But they would think they didn't know a gay person. So when they would see those TV shows or read those stories about all gay men committing suicide and all gay men being pedophiles, they'd think, oh, all gay men are like that. So there you go. Today, 9 out of 10 Americans say they personally know someone in their family or in their workplace who is gay or lesbian. So if they hear a story about a USC professor being a pedophile, they know that not all gay men are pedophiles because they have a gay guy at work and they have a gay guy, their great uncle, or their dad is gay, or their brother, or their son, or whatever. So that issue has been largely resolved for gay and lesbian people in terms of public perception versus what they see in the media. Only 8% of Americans say they know someone who is transgender. So literally, almost everything the American public knows about transgender people, they know from the media, because they don't have that personal connection, most of them, yet. Although I think our community is growing, and I think more people are coming out, but that's a whole other issue. So the power of the media to shape that cultural dialogue about how transgender people are seen, and to help eliminate that incredibly noxious, discriminatory culture we live in, is really in your hands. I mean, we do a lot in our own way to build our own community and to increase our resilience and to, you know, make policy change and to empower people. But to amplify our voices, literally, to use GLAAD's tag, we need your help. So getting those stories right and writing those stories is really critical. And I'm so happy you all came tonight to hear this panel.
I have two questions, actually. So at the risk of sounding sort of ignorant, I'm going to ask the first one. When you talk about trans women and trans men, so just to be clear, a trans woman is a person who is assigned male at birth and has transitioned to be female, correct?
Correct. And that's a good point, actually. That is something that still gets screwed up a lot. A lot of people get really, they're uncomfortable with that. And so we'll see a lot of reporting this last year. You probably saw a lot of reporting we did. Where people had said, you know, where they would say trans male, but they were actually meaning somebody who lives as female. So yes.
The idea is that you're being respectful by referring to them as a woman because that's how they're going to be today. It's like an easy way to remember. And transgender is an adjective, not a noun. So you never say a transgender. You say a transgender woman.
Okay. And then my second question, I don't know if you guys really talked about this, but I saw it up on the slides behind you. Just for the sake of being accurate in terminology, can you talk a little bit about what is the difference between a transgender person and I hope I get the terminology right, but a person who cross-dresses. So how do you define the difference between those?
A person who cross-dresses, what we used to call a transvestite, or what we call a drag queen or a drag performer, all of those things, is somebody who actually wears clothing of the sex opposite of what they are and what they identify with. So RuPaul is a cross-dresser. RuPaul identifies as a woman, identifies as a man and dresses as a woman, but RuPaul still knows at the end of the day he's a man, and, you know, in his normal life he presents as a man, and that's sort of his job, to dress up as RuPaul, for example, versus, somebody who's a trans woman is... that's actually that's how they live. They're not cross-dressing because they're wearing the clothing of the gender that they identify with. So when you wear female clothing, you're dressed as a woman because you're a woman. And that would be the same thing for a trans woman and not the same thing for a cross-dresser.
It's self-identification, how they live their life.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a quick question about, I hear, I'm sort of new at this kind of information. I hear people refer to their husbands, or their, a couple of you up there, you especially, have said, my husband. I'm confused. How do you decide whether someone's a husband or a wife? I remember meeting a woman who appeared to be a woman at a meeting several years ago, and she made a reference to her wife. And I thought, oh. And then I realized, okay, she was lesbian, and that was her way of describing the person that was your partner. Do you prefer husband or wife? How do you decide whether it's husband or wife? Isn't partner a simpler way of dealing with it?
I personally hate the word partner and have refused to use it, and because it's a clinical term and it sounds like a business relationship, and I do have business partners. So for me, it's important to distinguish between that. When I... when we were a lesbian couple, I always called my spouse my wife, and that I liked it because it was sort of in your face by claiming that identity, that I had a wife and I was a woman, and therefore you knew I was a lesbian, and so it was kind of roundabout. And when Jake transitioned, we actually had a quandary because we both felt really uncomfortable with the word husband at first, and so... Jake had actually, because it sounds weird to me, I never wanted to be a straight girl, so Jake at first said, why don't we try partner, can you just try partner for a while, and I really hated it. I tried it for a week, I couldn't stand it, and I just said, we've got to go with husband, I guess, so a lot of times I will use other euphemisms. I often call him my co-pilot, and a lot of people like that, because that's what he is, but he is my husband, because he's a man.
And we are legally married.
We are legally married, and that was part of claiming the word wife. We've had 5 wedding ceremonies, and like 3 of them have been legal for a hot minute. So, we were part of that wave of San Francisco weddings in 2004, and then 2008, and then we got married as a male and female. And so I've always wanted to denote that this is my spouse, that I'm legally wed, that my relationship is important as your relationship, and that's it.
I just want to speak to that briefly as well, because so I have been in a relationship with my husband for 12 years. He's a gay man. He's not a transgender man. And up until yesterday, we couldn't get legally married because the law sees me as male. So even though marriage equality may not be number 1 on the list of issues for the transgender community, it's big on the list of issues for me, because I can now legally marry my husband, and I fully intend to call him my husband, even though I still find it a little weird. Because, yeah, partner, especially after 12 years, referring to someone as your boyfriend is just ridiculous.
Yeah, the thing with a boyfriend. Yeah, you always sound like you're 14 when you use words like boyfriend and girlfriend. That's why you want to get away from it. I was going to say the thing about marriage equality, which is sort of off topic, but I just have to add, is that the thing is, marriage equality is absolutely trans rights, because in many states, it's up to the state to define what gender a trans person is. So in some states, you can be fully transitioned and living your life as a male, and the state will still define you as a woman. And thus, if you're even if you're living with a male and you're with a woman, so you seem like a heterosexual marriage, but the state can still define you as somebody in a same-sex relationship.
You're in Texas, that will happen.
Yeah, and you'll get, you know, so they won't recognize your relationship, you'll get your inheritance rights taken away, stuff like that. So marriage equality is absolutely a trans issue because many, many states won't see you as the gender that you present at. And so you don't even have to be a gay trans person to need that passage of marriage equality.
My question is, what's your take or your opinion about the coverage by ethnic-oriented media about the transgender community?
Sorry, I hate to keep talking so much. The GLAAD has a kick-ass Spanish language media program, and we have Monica Tosandas and Brian Pacheco who are here in LA, and they work with Spanish language media a lot. And at first it was a real struggle to get the word transgénero accepted because it was seen as an English word and they didn't want to use it. But they've made tremendous strides in that front. And actually, because again, I see the media awards, we've nominated a lot of things in Spanish language media that are really good about the transgender community. And I don't speak Spanish, so I kind of have to rely on them to translate it for me as it goes along. But really good. And one of the things, too, a lot of the stuff about terminology we've been talking about up here and the way people perceive each other, not entirely translatable to other cultures and other countries. And that doesn't mean one is right and one is wrong. It just means that we're a relatively new community, and as we are developing ways to tell our stories, they're not always exactly the same. So in certain Latin American cultures, the way transgender women might differentiate themselves from gay men may not be exactly the same as it is in some, you know, Mexico or Central America or South America. So that was one point I wanted to make. And then the other point is that I think there has been a lot of progress being made in like Spanish language media, which is the one that I can refer to. There are still some problems with some mockery of trans women and kind of exaggerated drag, and the show in Puerto Rico that just got canceled with the weird puppet. Can't remember the name of that. There was some bad stuff going on there. But in general, you know, there's been some really good progress. So I just wanted to say that.
Hi, everybody. You know who I am. I just wanted to make an example. The last 3 or 4 Southern Conferences in Atlanta, I've had the personal experience of having to deflate the media from coming to the event because they come in uncredentialed. And for those of you who don't know, Southern Comfort is the largest conference in the world for transgender people. It's in Atlanta, Georgia. And I wonder, Nick, how would you deflate them? Isaac, how would you deflate them? And everybody else, how would you deflate them? Because it came, not violent, but it came kind of very emotional because they tried to push their way into the conference. And I said, you know, you can't do this. It just isn't fair to people's privacy. So I want to hear your views on that, if I handled it properly or how you would handle it, because I am a media specialist like you are. Thank you.
So your question is, how would you deflect the media from attending the event?
It's a tough question. It's funny because the No Lose Conference has the same thing, and that's not about trans people at all. It's about fat people, and which I go to and am part of. But they have the same kind of thing where they don't let the media in because they want the privacy of people there. And from a media perspective, of course, it's sort of our job to get the hell in, you know? So I don't know how to answer that one.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I just came back from the Philadelphia Trans Health Conference, and that was huge. And, you know, anybody could just walk in and cover whatever they like, but I think what's really important is when these conferences are happening that there's actually guidelines and things posted around, because it's really important if media comes in and there's a youth parade a little youth parade that happens at Philly, and it's really important that youth aren't being filmed or their pictures aren't being taken, but, you know, still, you know, people will pull out their cameras. So I think it's around making sure that there's people in those conferences that are really really monitoring that.
Yeah, and maybe actually developing better relationships with the media would actually help you by sort of cultivating what it is they do have access to, like managing them more rather than letting them, you know, if there's a way for them to work through the system, then people, you know, especially because they've got to pay to get in, right? So if you reporters were super cheap. So we want to get in for free. So if you make a way for them to get in free and you give them access and you say, these are the things that you can report on, these are the things you can and cannot record, you know, these are the things you simply don't have access to, and make it, you know, spell it out. You know, conventions all over the country do that from you know, the task force, you know, in creating change conference does that to a certain extent. Comic-Con does that to a certain extent. So I think, you know, that would probably be the track that I would suggest.
Can I just, I'm sorry, Well, it's just responding to this. I'm Laura McGinnis, I'm the community consultant for the Charter Project, but I've also managed some of these access things. And from a media perspective, you want to be able to tell the story from a trans person's perspective or an LGBT person's perspective. They may not be out, it may not be safe. And that's why this question even comes up, is you need to be aware that the person or the story that you want to cover may not be safe to cover. So it is taking that extra step and working with the professionals that are with the organizing or with the organization that might be hosting the event or the activity to find those safe stories within. I know it sucks. I can tell you, as somebody who really wants to tell stories about young people who are in crisis, from a safety perspective, I never can. I can never give you what you want.
But, yeah, we're, you know, one of the things that you can do, for example, is that you've got a lot of fact sheets that tell us, you know, these alarmingly high numbers of suicide rates, and you do actually really kind of try to shepherd the media around different stories in particular ways. And so I think that they feel like they do have access when you're able to give them that information. And so
as much as you can, exactly, and that's how you can manage it. But for people who have never covered the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, or you find yourself covering, you know, it's completely off your beat, but you get it, as Nick was talking about, keep in mind that there is a level of safety, and that's why you want to be so concerned about asking these questions, asking about preferred gender pronouns, asking about names, and what parts of the story is this person or this community willing to do, and it really does come from a safety perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like, it really comes down to life or death for some people. I think that's really important to keep at the forefront.
Hi, my name is Ricardo. I'm a reporter at the LA Times. So my question kind of has to do with this. You know, as a reporter, we strive for accuracy, to be fair, to be ethical, et cetera, et cetera. And what have you used the term marriage equality? That's a term that we don't run in our news pages at the LA Times and the New York Times, any mainstream publication, because it is a term that has been crafted by, you know, groups like HRC to connote something. And it's got an activist, you know, connotation in that way. And, you know, the style guide that's posted behind you, you know, I think is very clear, and I think it's something that many editors would not take so much of an issue with. But, I mean, where, coming from your perspective, where do you meet mainstream organizations in the middle where the language isn't activist, where, you know, but it is accurate, you know, and fairly represents a group that, you know, as we know, doesn't get very much coverage?
Well, I mean, with the marriage equality issue, I'm LGBT media is largely advocacy media just because it has because it cares about LGBT people and doesn't have to pretend to be objective in that realm. From the mainstream media, you know, we've just been working with them to adopt the term same-sex marriage, because what we see out there a lot is gay marriage, which is not accurate to what's actually happening. So,
and that's as much as a politically loaded term as marriage equality. You know, like, I wouldn't call marriage equality the only message framework for this issue, because gay marriage has its own connotations as well.
Right, and it's not gay marriage, it's same-sex marriage. So, it's just not.
Or it's just marriage.
I mean, yeah.
And for same-sex couples.
That would be lovely, but yeah, we're talking about same-sex marriage. So, I think that's a case where we can meet, you know, mainstream media at a point where that is factually correct. There's no argument that that's an opinion of mine. And I think, though, eventually you're going to embrace marriage equality.
And I will say, Glad Style Guide, you know, it's interesting because Van actually works for an LGBT magazine, and you said it's mostly kind of advocacy due to the nature of it. And Diane has freedom to use language that I don't expect to see in the LA Times in the near future. So Glad Style Guide really is meant to be for that working journalist in a mainstream media outlet that is language that we feel like the American public is, you know, ready to hear or has already heard, or, you know, this is accurately reflects the, it's a balancing act to try to accurately reflect the complexities of the transgender community with at the same time making it language that could appear in a mainstream newspaper and Joe Schmo at home reading it over coffee, we hope still on paper, is going to, understand what that means, you know, because it's ridiculous to try to
communicate to people if you use language they don't even know what the heck it is, right? So you have to communicate to them in a way they can hear. So GLAAD Style Guide is written specifically for that. And I hope, and I'm glad you said that, I'm hoping that, that what you see there is that. And by the way, this is like 3 years old now, and so we're literally in the process of revising it and updating it. And it's not going to be like dramatic, radical, all new language for every journalist in the world to learn. But it is going to be a little bit more like, hey, it's the second decade of the 21st century. So now we need to start talking a little bit more complicated, you know, a little, you had 101 now for quite some time. Now we're going to go up to 102, you know. And that's the way we, you know, and I think the gay and lesbian movement used that strategy as well for many years to kind of get people familiar with the language and the concepts. So that is the goal of GLAAD Style Guide. And we're always trying to balance, like, you know, what I know about how the community actually speaks and then what the media can say in a way that people will hear.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm also a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. I feel like the few times we do get narratives about people coming out as trans, often the way those experiences are described are about sort of the times people first realize have to do with gender nonconforming experiences, right? And the concern I often wonder about is, how do we tell those stories without then setting up the idea that any sort of gender nonconforming experience means that you're trans or that sort of the traditional gender lines are so fixed? I guess it's often how the narrative is told. I'm wondering if you have suggestions about ways to avoid making it sound like, well, you know, this is the only way to be a woman, this is the only way to be a man, and so, you know, when you diverge from that, that means that, you know, clearly it's another identity.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about human interest stories, that it's you know, that you have a wider berth to sort of tell, you know, to, like, you know, have a narrative around that where you kind of build that into your story. I think the thing is with these sort of, these coming out stories, these, like, my awakening of my gender and my, you know, first experience of being gender nonconforming, very often they're the same for trans people as they are for queer people. So you have, for a lot of, like, you know, I have Jake's story, for example. I'll take my husband's story, just growing up as a child, you know, always wanted to play with the boys' toys, always wanted to do the boys' things, always wanted to dress like a boy. I've got plenty of lesbian friends that have the same exact story. So they diverge in some way at some point. And so that's the nut of what's different there. But I think it's really important to note that that's that individual's perspective, you know? And I think that maybe, you know, if it's a single solo narrative on one person, it may be a little bit harder and more work on your part. But if it's a larger piece, you can always bring in people who are talking about, for example, kids who are gender nonconforming. We have no idea if they're transgender. They're just not doing things the same way, because we have a lot of stories of those now, you know, a lot of young people who are not, you know, in one, it's like the blogger Raising My Rainbow who has the new book out, like, her kid is neither here nor there, you know, and that's okay. You know, it's building a new culture around that. So I think you have plenty of stories that you could funnel in to give supporting information. That's my feeling.
I also think it'd be great to, at some point soon, start moving beyond the coming out story for trans people. I mean, for decades, that's what you heard from gay people, was the coming out story, the coming out. I often say, like, I have to hear one more, like, gay coming out story. I'm just going to, like, you know. And yet, every year with the Media Awards, we'll nominate something that's like a gay coming out story, because someone will find a fresh take on it that's new and, you know, provide some more insight to it. But we had decades of gay coming out stories. And now, more and more, you see, I'm a gay pilot, I'm gay dads, I'm gay this. You know, like, it becomes more about their life and not that, when did you know you were gay? Although, apparently, that's what this TV show is about tonight on the Outlaws on HBO. But I haven't seen it yet, so maybe it's better than that. For trans people, we're still very much in that coming out narrative, coming out narrative, coming out narrative. And I'm the first person to admit that my life is really boring, and there's probably not a story about me 15 years later now, like, sitting down to watch, you know, True Blood with my husband. But there has to be, at some point, some way to begin telling the stories of trans people that's not about the coming out narrative. And that born in the wrong body cliche, which I am more than ready to see buried. Because it's a very simplistic, overly used sort of phrase that's kind of lazy writing to sort of synopsize something that's really much more nuanced than that.
So I'm kind of answering your question and yet at the same time taking the opportunity to say it's just killed born alone.
You know, the problem is that there's a lot of trans and gender nonconforming people who use that.
They do,
you know, and on the coming out stories, first of all.
Well, it's an easy way of describing the situation.
It dumbs it down.
Like you said, it's lazy, but it's also simple and it's
not overused.
Yeah.
It is. It's yeah. I mean, absolutely. But I think that you know, again, the reason why you know we do these coming out stories because of course I find them tedious. I've been doing this for 20 years, over 20 years now. But people love them,
yeah, know.
You know? I mean, that's the deal.
And,
you know, one of my specialties is getting celebrities to come out, and that's like the highest, you know, traffic we can get is a celebrity coming out as anything, basically.
Well, so, as you said, the coverage of the trans community is lagging behind the gay community.
Yeah,
so,
and,
you know.
And that's my thing, brother. You got, like, you know, 15 years left of coming out stories for trans folks.
I think we have time for one more question, so we must ask a question. One more question.
Fight over it.
I'm just curious. My name is Christine. I'm also at the Times. And one of the stories that I've read that I felt was poignant and like helped illuminate some issues for me was when I read about a former Times columnist, Christine Daniels. And I just wonder what you guys thought of the coverage. You know, obviously she had a lot to say about her own transition at the time. And then after the tragic events, there was writing about it afterwards. I mean, how did you react to that situation and that coverage?
Yeah, well, it was heartbreaking in our house, but certainly, you know, knowing Christine a little bit. So I'll let you answer it.
So she's talking about Christine Daniels, who's a sports writer for the LA Times and who very publicly transitioned from male to female and changed her byline in the paper. And the paper was very supportive, and she started writing a blog about her experiences, and she spoke at the NLGJA conference, which is the National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association. And then she ended up sort of taking a step back and returning to her old name and then committed suicide. So a really sad story, and I don't know Christine. I didn't know Christine. I don't know anything about her experience personally, so I can't speak to that per se, but I know that there was a lot of, that her life, as we saw it from the outside, illustrated a lot of issues trans people face. While her employer was supportive, apparently, from what I understand, her family was not. So if you are faced with a situation where you're being told if you transition, and I don't even know, I'm stepping aside from her situation entirely, I'm just going to say in general, trans women who have been married and have kids often are faced with the idea of losing custody of their kids entirely, that their families will shun them and you'll never see your kids again, and that's a very difficult thing to face. And another thing that's hard to face, I think, and this comes back to the media, is sometimes when people come out, Susan Stanton in Florida is another example, if they already have a little bit of a public profile, they go from being a very private person who's not involved in the trans community at all to getting tons of media attention and becoming the spokesperson for the trans community. And they often make mistakes because they don't understand the nuances of the trans community, and then the trans community gets angry at them, but they've been put in an awkward position of becoming a spokespeople, you know, like even though they've barely come out. So it's a lot of pressure. Somebody who did that really beautifully, I think, was Chaz Bono, who had not particularly been involved much in the trans community before he came out, and he made mistakes, don't get me wrong, but given the incredibly white-hot spotlight that he was put in, he made fewer than most people would make, I think. And so there's a lot of things wrapped up in Christine's story specifically that are illustrative of issues the whole community faces, and it brings me to another topic which I wanted to make, which Diana was talking about how things changed at The Advocate once she came on board. And, you know, the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association for years has been, you know, being a meeting place for gay and lesbian journalists to meet and talk about issues in the newsroom, talk about issues at their paper, be a resource for each other. And I personally don't know how many trans people are part of that group, but I'm guessing not very many. And I'm guessing at the LA Times there's a ton of gay and lesbian people on the staff. I don't know, but I'm guessing there's probably not one trans person on the staff at this point. There might be, don't get me wrong. But well, there's just fewer of us. So we're not there to be that voice in the editorial room. We're not there to be that voice on the staff.
And you mean out trans people?
Yeah, out trans people. That's a whole nother... Would you, somebody on the street, if I worked at the LA Times, you wouldn't necessarily know I was trans unless I told you. So, you know, so... You know, it's good if we could have our own advocates in the newsroom, that would be great, but there's just fewer of us, and there aren't that many out journalists now working in the industry that I'm aware of, a few here and there, for sure. So that's kind of my rambling answer of what your question brings up for me. I don't want to speak too much for Christine in general, specifically, I mean, because I didn't know her, except to say that it was really sad to see the pressures that she was under and the end result. And I often tell people who are thinking about coming out, like, proceed with caution. You know, I'm kind of glad Lana did. Because had she come out 5 minutes after she came out to herself and started talking to the media, she might have made mistakes. She might have been put in that position of, you now have to speak for all of us and don't you dare fuck up. And, you know, what are you going to lose in front of the whole world because you're transitioning? And so it was actually, I think, probably kind of good she took her time and felt like she was safe and in a good place where she could then turn and tell her story.
Also, the other thing, too, is it is not, it's not uncommon to see somebody, it's not uncommon for somebody to come out as transgender and have a very difficult time either keeping or getting a job, keeping custody of their children or their primary relationship, and then essentially going back in the closet and living as the gender that they had been presenting at all along. And so... and then there are trans people who are under that umbrella who are much more fluid and can move back and forth with ease because of their identity and stuff. Christine obviously was in the former camp. And I thought that the media coverage, I thought that the media coverage actually was pretty respectful. I thought that, though, that the media seemed very confused, you know, and so that was kind of the thing. I wish that there had been... sort of more, you know, people telling their stories of that would illuminate what was happening. I mean, it's hard to be a female sports writer, you know? And so you're talking about also, you know, coming out as trans in this really difficult, you know, field where it's just difficult for women, period. And then you add on this transgender element, and then you add on the family, and then you add on the media attention. And it is sort of a perfect storm. Of elements and stuff. So,
I just wanted to add that if somebody faces that kind of rejection and discrimination and they do choose to go back and detransition, it doesn't mean they're not transgender. It just means that they don't have the resources at that point to be able to survive the shitstorm that often results when you come out. And I also want to say the only thing I would say about the LA Times is I wish that her blog had not vanished because her blog was beautiful. And her blog was very much about how happy she was and the successes that she was feeling. And it's kind of like when the blog vanished, I felt like that part of Christine had vanished too. And I don't know why it vanished. There may have been a really good reason. But I had enjoyed reading it. And when she committed suicide and then that vanished too, it was like that one connection to Christine that was there was also gone.
Okay.
They're not
All right.
I think that wraps up the panel then. I have one question. On terminology. So would you, Diane, say you are a lesbian in a, would you call it a heterosexual marriage?
We call our marriage a queer marriage. Sure. We say we transitioned and we call it a queer marriage. And partly that is because both of us are strongly affiliated with the queer community, and even though Jake is attracted to women, he is you know, he came up and was raised in this community and knows more about lesbian feminism than I ever will. So you know, his attachment remains, and if people press me, I say queer, and then sometimes I say lesbian, and sometimes I say lesbian-identified bisexual or bisexual-identified lesbian, and basically it's all murky. I have a husband. I have a vagina. I still like lesbians, and I like to write about them.